go first. Raoul told her, Please do not tread upon my tail. I find it demeaning.
I haven't done that since I was 11,
Little Mouse said, smiling.
Yet, Raoul said.
Then he flicked his tail left and right and started down the tunnel. After he had taken a few steps, the clothing of the humans rustled, and they began walking steadily along behind him.
There was a strange scent in the tunnel, and Raoul noted it immediately.
It was creature flesh, he knew that much. Something had come into the spire from the surface, its scent pungent and unsettling in his nose. There was the foul taint to it that Raoul had learned to associate with poisonous, inedible kills while he was still a fuzzy little kit. So something particularly strange and perhaps particularly dangerous had recently been in this tunnel. Raoul objected. Granted, the Nine Claws territory was not his to defend, but it seemed grotesquely inappropriate that something should go to all the trouble of coming this far up the spire from the surface, only to prove utterly useless as food after it should be hunted. It seemed very rude to make a cat go to all the work of hunting and killing it, and then not provide the victory feast after the successful conclusion to the hunt.
Ahead, Folly breathed. Something. The ceiling.
They had to walk another 40 steps, fewer for the humans, he supposed, before even his eyes could make out something in the near-perfect shadows of the tunnel's ceiling. The ceiling was perhaps 2 or 3 pounces above them, and made of conventional stone rather than spire stone. The humans of Habbel Landing had halved the height of the tunnels as well, though Raoul was sure he did not know why they would do such a foolish thing. To provide more tunnels for the top half of their Habbel, Raoul supposed. There was, Raoul noted, a hole in the ceiling, as wide as the length of his body and tail. From the hole trailed dozens of long lines of some kind, something like all the long ropes on Grimm's airship, but made of different material than those had been. They stirred gently in the breeze of the tunnel. As they did, they reflected hundreds of tiny random colours of light from the jar Folly carried. It was a moment more before Little Mouse and Folly were able to see the lines, and at that point their steps slowed and stopped.
What is that? Little Mouse breathed. What are those ropes made of?
Ether silk,
Folly whispered.
"Ether silk rope?" Little Mouse asked, her mouth open. "Who could afford to make such a thing?" "It isn't rope," Folly told her jar, "but she doesn't know that. She's probably never seen what it looks like before it's been harvested."
"Harvested?" Little Mouse asked. Then she drew in a short, sharp breath.
"Silk weavers. That's what you mean, isn't it?"
Folly stared at the hole as though she could not look away and nodded in silence. Bridget shook her head.
"But they live on the surface and in the mists. They don't... To weave a strand that big, they would have to be enormous. And God in heaven, what lunatic would attempt to tame them? Fools have been trying to domesticate them for their silk for 2,000 years with no success, with no survivors."
"In my opinion, humans are sufficiently foolish to attempt it again," Raoul noted.
"Oh!"
Folly said suddenly, and staggered back several steps, flinching away from some unseen threat.
"Watch out!"
Raoul stared at the odd human, and for a baffled second nothing happened. And then there was a chorus of high-pitched, eerie sounds, and dozens of silk weavers plunged through the hole and plummeted toward them. Raoul had never seen one of the creatures before, but he had learned his people's lore about the silk weavers, along with a nightmarish menagerie of creatures like them. He knew them, knew how they hunted, and he knew how to kill them. The first movements proved to be half a dozen creatures, about half of Raoul's own size, he estimated. They had a dozen legs, spread out along either side of a lean, hard-scaled body that made them look something like overly enthused silverfish. Their heads, however, were bulbous, sporting short muzzles that opened in three parts that were all serrated along the inside. Streamers of silk issued from their rear parts, providing a kind of drop line that they would use to control their fall. The fresh exuded silk, Raoul remembered, was quite adhesive and presented additional danger. It would not do to be hasty. So he contemplated his actions carefully, until the silk weavers had fallen almost halfway to the tunnel floor. And then he moved. He bounded up, not at the lowermost of the falling silk weavers, but at the highest. He slammed both front paws into the thing, stiff-legged, and shoved it back. Raoul used the momentum to twist in the air and land on his feet, his head already tracking to see the results of his attack. His victim swung in a wide arc, its silk line tangling with those of its companions. The silk weavers let out whistles of distress as the sticky silk at their rear ends clung to other lines and weavers alike. One of them became hopelessly tangled, and two more had legs wound up in twists of silken line. The other three managed to escape the tangle and drop to the floor. Raoul pounced on the first and batted it as hard as he could with his paws, knocking it away onto its side. The second got the same treatment, and then the third leapt upon Raoul. The warrior cat had been waiting for the stupid things to get around to that. He flung himself in the direction of the silk weaver's leap, flipping himself onto his back in a sinuous motion as he did. The silk weaver came down, poisonous jaws questing for his flesh, and he held it away with his front paws. While raking savagely with the claws on his rear legs at its vulnerable underside, the silk weaver's legs convulsed as Raoul hit something vital, and the cat flung it off him contemptuously. Neither of the other two had risen to their many legs yet, and were still thrashing on the stone floor. He pounced on the nearest, got a good grip on its underbelly with his jaws, and before it could curl and bite him, he shook it savagely, ripping the frail underbody open. It let out a shriek like the first, legs thrashing, and tumbled free, leaving a mouthful of its vitals behind. Raoul spat the foul-tasting thing out of his mouth and turned toward the third silkweaver, only to see Little Mouse's large, sturdy shoe come crushing down on the thing like a column of living stone. The silkweaver was quite simply no match for that kind of mass and strength, and it didn't so much die as explode in every direction. Raoul whirled toward the tangled silk weavers, leapt upon one of them, and killed it with his jaws, taking care to avoid the silk himself. And while he did, Little Mouse stomped the remaining two silk weavers into splatter marks on the floor. Handy, humans, Raoul thought. Clumsy, slow, and not always terribly bright. But they were very, very strong, through sheer, inarguable mass. He now saw his father's wisdom in desiring to keep a few of them around the home tunnels. They could manage annoying problems that might prove awkward and time-consuming for cats. Raoul looked around calmly for more foes to defeat, but he'd run out of enemies with which to amuse himself. Just as well, he supposed. It tasted horrible, and it would take him a week to get all of their goo and stench out of his fur.
"Well, I have saved you both,"
Raoul said to the humans.
"Though I will concede, Little Mouse, that you were not entirely useless to me in this matter."
"Thank you," Little Mouse said gravely. She examined the bottom of her stomping shoe and shuddered. "Ugh, how revolting!"
"How useless," Raoul said, disgusted. "It was barely a fight at all. And we can't even eat them."
"Just as well," Little Mouse said. They have a poisonous bite, do they not?
Were any of us bitten? Raoul asked.
No.
Then no, Raoul said simply. They obviously did not.
He gave her gauntlet a pointed glance.
An unused weapon is not a weapon at all.
I didn't have time to aim it before they were bouncing all over the floor, Little Mouse said. And after that, they were all around you. You did ask me not to step on your tail with my boots. I assumed you would not want me to step on it with my gauntlet either.
Raoul considered that and nodded.
That does not seem unreasonable, I suppose. Presumptuous, but not stupid.
Thank you,
Little Mouse said, in that tone of voice that sometimes made Raoul wonder whether she was in some way mocking him. He couldn't be sure. Little Mouse was woefully lacking in ears, and had no tail whatsoever. How on earth was one supposed to know what was going on behind those enormous myopic eyeballs without some kind of cue?
So that's what that is like,
the odd human was saying. She shivered.
Weavers! Weavers! Run!
Folly,
Little Mouse said.
It's all right. They're dead. We've killed them.
Folly shook her head in a jerky motion and jabbed a finger upward.
Bridget doesn't know, she whimpered. Bridget doesn't. There! There! There!
And with that, a flood of silk weavers poured from the hole in the ceiling. They were all more or less the same size as the first group of creatures, but there were more of them. Not dozens, not scores. Hundreds. Hundreds and hundreds of them, pouring out like water in a chorus of shrieks, a rattling thunder of clashing serrated jaws, swarming down the already hanging silk lines like inverted aeronauts, like fleets of them. It was just possible that there were too many for Raoul to exterminate alone.
Run!
Little Mouse bellowed. She grabbed Folly, and Raoul flung himself into a run beside them. The Etherealist's apprentice and the two guardsmen, neither of whom were guarding anything, or, in point of fact, men, took off down the hallway at a frantic sprint. A chittering tide of silk weavers boiled along behind them. Chapter 35 Spire Albion, Havel Landing, Ventilation Tunnels. Just before the original six silk weavers hurled themselves at them, Folly had watched it happen. It had been quite unnerving, really. She had stared at the hole in the ceiling and suddenly felt the utter irrational certainty that six silk weavers were hurtling out of it. She could see nothing, and yet she felt that she could have counted the spiky hairs on their many legs if she'd cared to do so. While her eyes told her the space was empty, every primitive nerve in her body had fired off howls of panicked warning, and she had been able to do nothing but flinch and scream. It was a second later before the silk weavers actually appeared, and Folly, confused, had simply stared as Raoul and Bridget dispatched them. She hadn't been stunned for very long, really. That cat had moved with an utter disregard for the superior numbers of the foe, and, for that matter, of gravity. Within a handful of seconds, the six silk weavers had died. Folly saw the conclusion of the fight in her thoughts a few seconds before it actually ended, which could only mean she had successfully tracked a possible future.
"Oh,"
she heard herself say.
"So that's what that is like."
And then a stirring in the ether, like the first that had warned her of a malicious presence beyond the hole in the ceiling, slithered through the air, only this one was far, far larger. Folly immediately tilted her head to one side, struggling to track the sensation. Her eyes slipped out of focus because they were of no use, no use at all, and she shuddered as she realized what she was feeling. Another possible future coalescing before her mind's eye. And this future included more silk weavers. Hundreds more.
"Weavers,"
she breathed.
"Weavers! Run!"
"Folly," Bridget said. "It's all right. They're dead. We've killed them."
Folly shook her head as the malicious presence in the ether suddenly looked back at her. A shock of immaterial sensation as unsettling as a sudden scream in one's ear. That presence seemed to focus on her, and then it began to rush closer. That was when Folly understood for the first time the nature of the enemy her master had warned her about. Those hadn't been silk weavers that Raoul and Bridget had dispatched. They'd been puppets.
"Bridget doesn't know,"
Folly said to the empty air, struggling desperately to latch onto the same sense of distilled instinct that had let her track the future of the initial attack. The invisible sense of 1,000 images blurred through her mind, like 100 people singing different songs all at once. It was painful, and she felt that she had glimpsed only the barest trace of possibility. She could possibly escape, and Raoul might have a chance, but...
"Bridget doesn't,"
she said aloud. She looked around wildly, trying to find more futures, a path to survival for all of them, but it was like trying to catch a specific gnat out of a cloud of them. Bright chances flitted by nimbly, and Folly struggled to understand them before they vanished.
There was one, and there, and there.
She was barely aware that her mouth was moving.
There, there, there.
Even as she spoke, the future coalesced into certainty, and she had less than a second's premonition before the silk weavers physically poured down from the lair above them. She needed a future with life in it, and sought desperately, while a hideous horde of painful, increasingly probable futures assaulted her thoughts like pieces of stinging hail striking her skull. It was new and odd and utterly terrifying. For some part of her actually lived through each future she saw. She fought to hang on to it, but she could not retain the vision, and it vanished.
"Run!"
Bridget bellowed, and Folly felt herself being propelled. She stumbled into a run beside the taller girl, and the horde of little silk weavers came after them. She struggled for a few seconds more to attain enough clarity and calm to see the future, to find some path to survival. And then abandoned the effort. That was the mark of a true master etherealist, the ability to look into the future in any circumstance, no matter how dire, and it required a level of self-mastery and concentration that she had clearly not yet attained. Bridget twisted to unleash the fury of her gauntlet into the swarm behind her, but she might as well have been tossing stones at a grease fire for all the good it did. Of course, looking on the bright side, there were so many silk weavers that Bridget could hardly miss, could she? So at least they had that going for them. But the silk weavers were gaining. Folly forced herself to order her thoughts, as the master had so often practiced with her. It would have helped if she could have sat down in a nice lotus position and breathed quietly for a while. But the silk weavers seemed unlikely to extend that courtesy to her. So she made do with synchronizing the beat of her thoughts to that of her pounding heart and running feet, and the etheric world opened itself to her. Everything changed. The world faded into an utterly black void, ablaze with traceries of etheric light. The tiny crystals in her jar twinkled brightly, and the weapon crystal of Bridget's gauntlet glowed like a miniature sun. Raoul and Bridget appeared to her as phantoms, partially illuminated by the glow of etheric energy passing through them, but mostly to be seen as shadows where that energy was absent. Pulsing streamers of energy flooded through the walls and floor of the spire, the spire stone drawing it from the sky and conducting it down through its matter to the earth, a lightning rod being continuously struck. She cast a glance over her shoulder and saw the horde of silk weavers shining like an out-of-control fire, every single creature ablaze with clouds of light. Using this portion of her mind to see, Folly could peer through the seemingly solid stone as if it had not been there at all, though it was a rather dizzying, disorienting activity within a spire. There were myriad flows of energy going generally downward, but also lancing back and forth through channels in the spire stone, placed there by the builders so that the spire's systems could support the lives of its residents. If a truly complex clock had been manufactured out of translucent glass, Folly imagined, her current quandary might be an experience similar to trying to find a single part located somewhere within it. They needed a smaller tunnel, something that would let them pass through easily but bottleneck their pursuers, slowing them, and Folly found one at hand. Now, if she could only find an etheric nexus, there might be more possibilities open to her.
"That way!"
she shouted to her jar, and abruptly turned down a much narrower passage with a much lower ceiling.
"Folly!"
Bridget shouted in protest, but it wasn't as though the larger girl had any choice in the matter of which way to go. Folly had the only light. Bridget slipped on her silk-weaver-slimed shoes, righted herself, ducked, and plunged into the smaller tunnel after Folly. Raoul entered behind Bridget, letting out a snarling, hissing cat scream of warning at the foremost silk-weavers as he did, and the three of them fled down the much more constricted hallway. Their footsteps were loud in here, their breathing deafening. Bridget had to run in a crouch, but the tide of silk-weavers pursuing them had to slow at the entrance, like water pouring from a small hole in a large vessel. Their pursuers were no fewer in number, but fewer could approach them at once, and that was very nearly the same thing for Folly's purposes. Though now that she considered it, Folly had never regarded herself as the sort of young woman who had purposes, precisely. That was potentially a troubling development. Not nearly so troubling as being torn to pieces by thousands of silk-weavers, of course, but it was a matter upon which to be deliberated. Assuming, of course, that she survived the next few moments. Folly led them down the choked hallway, slowing her steps slightly so that she could sweep her ether-focused gaze around them for further options. And then, suddenly, she was able to see one of the things that might change the situation. A nexus. Flows of etheric energy coursed down from half a dozen directions, pouring into a single downward-flowing conduit. And at the point where they merged together, excess energy overflowed the conduit, spreading out into the air of the tunnel in a gossamer backwash. That cloud of etheric force all but sang to Folly, and she rushed forward in a desperate sprint, panting, fumbling for her pistolier's holsters as she went.
"Folly!"
shouted Bridget from behind her. "Wait!" There wasn't time. Not if the tide of silk-weavers was to be stemmed quickly enough to save Bridget's life. Folly ripped out the two mesh sacks of quiescent lumen crystals from the holsters and gave them a quick snap, one at a time, dumping their contents onto the floor of the tunnel. Then, without hesitating, she smashed her jar of crystals down to the stones as well. And for an instant, the tunnel went completely dark. Folly could see, of course, by the fey illumination of her ether sight, but she supposed it might have been a terrifying moment for Bridget, who unleashed a despairing shriek. But that, Folly supposed, was only because Bridget had never seen what an etherealist, even an imperfectly trained one like Folly, could do with a supply of ready energy and vessels to contain it.
"All of us together now!"
Folly admonished the crystals, and felt their sleepy, rather muzzily confused sense of aggregate agreement. And then she seized upon the freely flowing etheric energy with her thoughts, and sent it coursing down into the crystals. Infused with energy far beyond that which had originally been stored within them, the little lumen crystals' radiance swelled from faint, ghostly glows to a thousand merry pinpoints of radiance, a sudden well of white light. Shrieks of surprise and distress arose from the silk-weavers, a surge of raw sound compressed by the narrow confines of the tunnel into a sledgehammer. Folly did her best to ignore its impact and staggered only a little. Then she threw her hand out toward the tunnel down which they had just fled, giving the flows of energy a quick mental nudge
and sent a spray of little crystals flying down the silkweaver-filled hallway in a glittering cloud that scattered among the silkweavers in an entirely random distribution. The next part was tricky, and Folly hoped that the crystals remembered her endless practice sessions. Lumen crystals were designed to accept a charge of etheric energy and output a steady trickle of light. But light was really just one of any number of possible expressions of energy. Weapons crystals did the same thing, only with heat and force. Lift crystals expressed that energy in a form of inverted gravity. And the most complex crystals of all, power core crystals, expressed their energy in another form. Electricity. There was no difference between a lumen crystal and a power core, really, except that the power core crystal was grown with the complex pathways needed to route etheric energy into a rising surplus, converting it into bottled lightning. There was no reason a little lumen crystal could not do the same thing, assuming that someone was willing to provide them with a blueprint of the necessary structured paths. So Folly, as quickly and ably as she could, imagined the precise sort of pathways her little crystals would need to employ. That was a fairly elemental exercise, but doing it 1,000 times all at once was something of an ambitious effort, more so than any she had successfully used in her practice sessions. Of course, the practice sessions had been embarked upon with the precise goal of providing her with the skill she'd need for a moment just such as this. Goodness, think of what trouble they'd be in if Folly hadn't practiced. So because it was right and necessary to do so, she simply imagined 1,000 different, complex, unique little paths for her baby lumen crystals all at once. Well, she shouldn't exaggerate, really, since that was boastful. There were 987 crystals on the floor, so she modestly imagined 987 patterns, one for each little crystal, to show them how to use the energy she was feeding them. And the hallway behind them, and every silk weaver in it, was suddenly wreathed in a latticework of blinding blue-white lightning. The noise of it was really quite startling, a cloud of individual snap cracks that sounded rather similar to the discharge of a weapons crystal, only since there were 987 of them, all within the same second or two, the noise was equivalent to a small army firing a fusillade within the confines of the little access corridor. The heat was fearsome as well, and with the heat came a blast of wind that was, Folly felt, really quite unnecessary to the process. Neither adding significant fearsomeness to the unleashed energy, nor accomplishing anything other than to knock Folly and Bridget down soundly, and to scatter her matrix of lumen crystals hither and yon. Folly lay on the floor after, because it seemed the proper thing to do. She blinked several times up at the ceiling, and realized that, without her ether sight, she could not be sure she was in fact looking at the ceiling at all. When one assumed, one quite frequently was correct, but it was hardly a constant. There was etheric energy spilling from the nexus still, and Folly waved her hands at it vaguely, sending it out toward her little crystals. Without Folly's thought to guide them, they were once more innocent of the knowledge of how to turn etheric force into violent death. The little crystals began to glow cheerfully, lighting the entire length of the access tunnel. Folly turned her head to find Bridget staring, most definitely, at the ceiling. The larger girl had a scorch mark on her chin and a long scratch along her hairline that had bled toward her eye without obscuring it. She blinked several times and then looked around them dazedly. Folly turned her head the other way to find Raoul standing over her. The cat's fur stood straight out in every direction, though there were uneven gaps here and there where it had been singed away. The cat's expression, Folly noted, was very cat-like. Raoul swatted her nose firmly with one paw,
claws sheathed. Then, with massive dignity, he rose and firmly turned his back on Folly to walk over to Bridget, nuzzling her and letting out an encouraging purr. Folly continued to lie meekly on the floor. Raoul, she thought, probably had some sort of point. She really hadn't expected quite that much excitement. What would the master think? He did so disapprove of showing off. And besides, she felt quite thoroughly exhausted, at least as sleepy as her brood of tiny crystals. Bridget sat up slowly. She turned her gaze up and down the hallway. The air was full of the stench of scorched silk weavers, though there really wasn't a great deal left of them. A leg here, a bit of shell there, a fang there. The hallway was black with fine ash. The former Vatterist shook her head slowly and said in an awed tone, "Folly, your little crystals did this."
"Don't brag," Folly admonished her crystals firmly. "You couldn't have if I hadn't shown you how."
Bridget blinked several times.
"You did this?"
Folly sighed and closed her eyes. She really did feel quite tired.
"As an exercise,"
she mused aloud.
"It was really quite simple.
Not at all easy,
but quite simple."
"I don't..."
Bridget began.
"I had no idea. That was..."
Folly had been trained for this as well. Most folk had no idea how formidable an etherealist's skills could be when applied properly. When they learned, their general reaction was, she had been assured, one of understandable if irrational fear. Which was a shame, because it had seemed that Bridget might have been a rather lovely friend, and she really didn't want to start crying. It would be perfectly awkward.
"Amazing," Bridget finished. "God in heaven, Folly, I thought we were finished. Well done."
Folly blinked, opened her eyes, and stared at Bridget for a moment. Then she felt herself smile. She looked down very quickly as Bridget's shape went all blurry. How odd that suddenly her tears did not feel awkward at all. Then Raoul let out a sharp hiss. Folly felt it at the very last instant, too late, the awful attention of the awareness she'd sensed before, while they were searching for the nine claws. It was the enemy. She felt almost certain. She couldn't think of a better sobriquet for the malevolent presence that had been driving the silkweavers like an enormous threshing machine intent on murdering them. It was as if the spirit of hatred itself had been given a mind and a dark will, and was eager to convey its malice through the medium of the hideous creatures of the surface. What kind of creature could have such a horrible will? How could such an intangible thing be fought? In a lifetime of strangeness, Folly had never heard of such a thing before, and she found that it frightened her a very great deal. That same enemy presence now sent a trio of the little creatures, burned and mangled, but alive and obviously dangerous, toward Folly's weary recumbent form. Everything happened very, very quickly. Raoul let out a shrieking snarl and flung himself on the silk weaver farthest to one side. Then there was the howl of a discharging gauntlet, and the second silk weaver vanished, burned and blown to bits by the blast of Bridget's gauntlet. The third silk weaver flung itself onto Folly's face, and was intercepted just short of it by Bridget's fist. The larger girl simply drove her arm down like a steam engine's piston, crushing the silk weaver to the spirestone floor and ending its attempts on Folly's life with a perfect brutal finality.
"Oh!"
Folly breathed. Her heart was racing painfully.
"Oh, my!"
"There," Bridget said, nodding in satisfaction. "Raoul?" The cat had finished dispatching his opponent and approached, shaking one of his front paws in pure distaste.
"They are the last,"
the cat reported.
Can I use my metal circles to hire a human to clean my paws? Is there a human who could do so competently?
I shall do it, Bridget said, rising. She winced and touched her cut lightly.
But I desire competence,
Raoul protested.
You are too rough with your wet cloths. If you would only use your tongue, as is proper.
I think not, Bridget replied firmly. I know where your paws have been. She offered Folly her hand. Can you rise? Folly took her friend's hand and rose. She wobbled for a moment, but Bridget steadied her until the hall stopped spinning hatefully about. Raoul, Bridget said, are these silk weavers grown?
They are grown as much as they ever shall be,
Raoul said with satisfaction.
You know what I mean.
I do not think they are mature,
Raoul replied.
My people's lore suggests that adults are 2 or 3 cat weights or larger.
Hatchlings, Bridget said, frowning. Could little silk weavers like this have spun the lines we saw back at the hole in the ceiling?
Oh,
Folly said.
Oh, Bridget is clever, in a very horrifying sort of way. No, these little things could not have done so.
Adults had to lay eggs and spin those lines, Bridget said.
But if only the hatchlings remained to attack us.
Raoul growled. Indeed. Where are the adults?
Folly's heart began to race in real panic this time.
Oh,
she breathed, her instincts screaming to her precisely where the enemy would direct its deadliest weapons.
Master!
Chapter 36 Spire Albion, Habble Landing, The Black Horse Inn. It was well after midnight. Gwen felt simple-minded with exhaustion, and the Spireark's master etherealist was leading the bar in an enthusiastic round of Farmer Long's Cucumber, a song that featured a number of shocking concepts Gwen had scarcely encountered before that night, along with what seemed to be an infinite number of verses.
"Really, Benedict," she complained, "I'm sure I've no idea where you could have learned such a crass piece of exploitative trash."
"And she hid it there again," Benedict sang, grinning before turning to his cousin. "From Esterbrook, naturally."
"The cad! Are you almost out of verses, at least?"
Benedict took a sip of his drink, his expression scholarly. Marines on an airship apparently make a custom of writing more verses to their favorite songs during their tours of duty.
"Only the best." "You mean most obscene?" Gwen interjected.
Benedict bobbed his head in acknowledgement. "Only the best are retained. But even so, after several centuries of sailing tradition..." Gwen arched an eyebrow.
"You're telling me that they're going to go on all night, aren't you?"
"Well past that, if they don't get tired of it," Benedict said. He squinted up at the cheery, ruddy-cheeked etherealist. "One wonders, though, where Master Ferris learned them."
"I was once a marine, of course,"
Ferris bellowed. Then he and several customers of the pub shouted in unison,
"Semper Fortitudo!"
Gwen sighed.
"Fortitudo, Miss Lancaster?"
Master Ferris said, and plopped from the table down into his chair with the grace, or at least the drunken recklessness, of a much younger man.
"An old, old word, even by my standards. Do you know what it means?"
"Strength," Gwen said promptly.
"Always strong."
"Ah,
but what kind of strength?"
Ferris asked, over the roar of a new singer taking over more verses of the song. This one featured Farmer Long's cucumber falling in a mud hole, and Gwen wanted nothing to do with it.
"Sir?" "There are many, many kinds of strength. Fortitudo refers to something quite specific." He poked a finger at Benedict's biceps in demonstration.
Not this kind of brute power, not at all. It means something more. Inner strength. Strength of purpose. Moral courage. The strength required to fight on in the face of what seems to be certain defeat. The strength to carry on faithfully when it seems no one knows or cares.
He swirled his cup and eyed Gwen.
And the strength to sacrifice oneself when that sacrifice is what is required for the good of others, even when one could offer someone else up instead. Especially then.
Gwen smiled briefly.
How, pointlessly trivial? Ferris suggested quickly.
I was going to say interesting, Gwen said in a mild tone. And that's as close to diplomatic as she gets, Benedict noted. Gwen kicked her cousin's ankle beneath the table.
Master Ferris, it grows late.
Indeed, the etherealist said, and stifled a yawn with one hand.
Perhaps we should consider discontinuing our investigation until we have heard from our field agents.
You mean the cat? Gwen asked.
Quite.
Master Ferris suddenly peered at Benedict.
I say, boy, what's caught your interest?
Benedict's feline eyes were focused on the bar at the far side of the room, where the master of the house was speaking in a low voice with a newcomer, his expression intent. The fellow was a broad, burly man in green aviation leathers and a greatcoat trimmed in the thick grey-brown fur of some creature of the surface, making his already massive shoulders look inhumanly broad. The coat's sleeves bore the two broad rings of an airship's captain. His square face was ruddy and getting ruddier, and he slammed a blocky fist down onto the bar hard enough to be heard even over the singing crowd.
What?
One thick fist shot across the bar and seized the innkeeper by the front of his suit. The frantic innkeeper darted a nervous glance over toward their table and spoke in a low, hurried voice to the burly aeronaut.
Ah, said Benedict, I think now I see why our host was so reluctant to rent you the room, cuz. He'd already promised it elsewhere.
That isn't a fleet uniform, Gwen noted.
It is not, Benedict said. Not a uniform at all, really. He must be a private captain.
Olympian, I should think, from the colours and the fur trim of his coat, Master Ferris put in. Olympian and, it would seem, possessed of a fury. Which is funny, if you know enough history.
The Olympian released the innkeeper after a few more low, choice words and then stalked toward their table, scowling. Gwen studied him the way she'd been taught to consider possible opponents, and found herself growing alarmed. The man moved far too lightly on his feet for someone with a build so powerful, and his balance, as one might expect from an aeronaut, was excellent. Worse, his eyes were quick and alert, sweeping the room as he moved, the mark of a man who was on guard for trouble. Gwen had attained some modest skills in the hand-to-hand combat arts of the Weyists, but she had, or so she thought, no illusions about her ability to deal with a much larger or better trained opponent without the element of surprise to support her skill.
Benny,
Gwen said,
unless you think we should shoot him.
I'm not the one who bought his bed out from under him, cuz, Benedict said.
This situation looks like it needs smoothing to me.
I'd rather not be transmogrified into paste while trying it, Gwen said.
Benedict sat back in his chair, his eyes amused, and said diffidently,
Did you, however, briefly consider talking to him, just for the sake of novelty?
He doesn't look like a man who would react well to threats.
An extremely fine coat. Master Ferris mused. They don't give those to just anyone, do they?
Benedict arched an eyebrow at the etherealist and said to Gwen,
I said talk as opposed to threaten.
Though one hardly needs struggle to see the possibility that you might not understand the distinction.
You make me sound like a perfect ogre, Gwen said.
"'But an articulate, wealthy, and very stylish one, cuz,' Benedict said. "'Beautiful, too. "'Try it. Just for fun. "'And if it doesn't work out, "'we can always grind his bones to make our bread later.' "'Or,' Master Ferris mused, "'be ground, as the case may be.' "'The Olympian captain reached their table, "'slammed his fist down on it hard enough "'to make all of the crockery and utensils "'jump up off the surface,' and demanded, "'Get out of my room!' Gwen didn't mind the threat display so very much. God in heaven knew she'd made a few herself in the past several days, but neither did she care for it, nor feel terribly frightened by it. She was, after all, wearing a gauntlet. But then, she noted, so was the Olympian. "'I'm very sorry to have inconvenienced you, sir,' Gwen said, "'but my associates and I required the room.' It might be better if you looked elsewhere. The man, who had been staring hard at Benedict, turned his eyes to Gwen for a flickering glance before tracking back to the warrior-born.
She speak for you?
For the purposes of this discussion, I'm afraid so, Benedict replied.
Fine,
the man said, and turned to face Gwen, looming over her.
Then you... Go gather up everyone's things and get them out of my room, girl. Now!
She recognized the tone of absolute authority in the man's voice, and she did not care for it at all.
Introductions,
she said crisply. That gave the Olympian an instant's pause.
What?
You have not introduced yourself, sir,
Gwen said, her voice hard.
I should like to know your name before I exchange another word with you.
The man straightened, his eyes narrowed, and then he shook his head.
Bloody Albion fuss bothers.
He took a deep breath, visibly controlling more vile language, and then said,
Pine, Commodore Horatio Pine, of the Half Moon Merchant Company out of Olympia, and I don't give a tenth crown who you are. That suite is reserved for my captains and myself. And we've just walked a mile on the surface to get to this bloody spire, and nearly got shot up by your own bloody fleet when we finally made it through. I am in no mood for games.
Gwen nodded.
My name is Gwendolyn Lancaster, of the House of Lancaster. Yes, before you ask, those Lancasters, the ones who made the crystals that are most probably keeping your ships in the air, sir. And while I sympathize with your plight, I am afraid that I still require those rooms.
So yourself and your friends can do some comfortable drinking?
Pine spat.
I've got wounded men who need good rooms and the attention of physicians, and this bloody habble is packed to the roof. Get out of those rooms, or by God in heaven and the long road both. I will leave you all unconscious in an alley, and move my men in anyway.
"'Perhaps such brutish thuggery is how things are done in Olympia,'
Gwen said, her voice lashing out like a whip's crack.
"'But in Albion, sir, there is rule of law, and I shall be pleased to defend myself against any such violence.'
Pine narrowed his eyes, then he said to Benedict,
"'You sure she speaks for you?'
Benedict sighed and leaned forward to lightly thump his forehead down onto the table, several times.
"'I didn't threaten him,'
Gwen protested to her cousin. There was a sharp sound of crockery breaking, and Gwen turned to find that Master Ferris's mug had dropped from suddenly limp fingers. He made a soft sound and twitched several times, then he shivered and his eyes closed. Gwen traded a look with Benedict and held up a forestalling hand to Commodore Pine.
"'Master Ferris?' she asked after a moment. "'Master Ferris, are you quite all right?'
Ferris opened his eyes, rose calmly, and said in a level tone,
"'Sir Benedict, I wonder if you would be so good as to draw your sword. Miss Lancaster, prime your gauntlet, if you please.'
He took his chair and slid it over to Commodore Pine.
"'This, sir, is for you.' You'll find it quite wieldy, I expect.
Pine blinked several times.
What? Gwen, Benedict snapped, rising and drawing his sword, his eyes everywhere.
Gwen swallowed and instinctively put her back to Benedict's, and as Master Ferris had instructed, primed her gauntlet, the weapon crystal on her palm swelling to glowing life. And then the doors of the black horse exploded open, and high-pitched alien shrieks filled the air. Chapter 37 Spire Albion, Havel Landing, The Black Horse Inn. The doors to the Black Horse slammed into the walls framing them, and what could only be a creature of the surface world squeezed inside. The thing was leathery and enormous, double or triple the mass of the largest man Gwen had ever seen, but it somehow managed to compress itself and come through the door without slowing down. Its segmented body was something like a spider's, but with four sections instead of two, elongated grotesquely, and some kind of dark grey carapace covered its back in flexible, articulated plates. It had too many legs to be a spider, too, all of them thick and massive at the base, covered in thickets of some kind of spine or rigid, sharp-looking hairs. Its head was hideous, Gwen thought. It was half shrouded in protrusions of its armor, wide and flat, with a nest of beady, gleaming eyes on either side, and a set of massive jaws hinged to great, bulging muscles along its skull. It slammed the door to the Black Horse closed, and then its rearmost legs spun a coil of some viscous gray substance onto the door behind it.
"Silkweaver!"
someone cried. The room erupted into panic. Patrons lunged up out of their seats, screaming. Some of them ran toward the stairway to the private rooms. Most fled toward the opposite door or the kitchen. A handful drew swords and raised gauntlets. The Silkweaver gave them no time to attack. It flung itself to the far side of the room, hurling its massive body into a luckless patron in aeronaut's leathers, smashing the man into the spire-stone wall of the inn with an audible cracking of bones. The Silkweaver then slammed the other door closed, and once more webbed it shut, while its eyes scanned the room, looking, she realized, for a target. As it did, it distractedly seized a reeling patron with its long front set of limbs and slammed the man to the floor with casual, lethal power.
"Dear God in heaven," Gwen breathed, a chill settling in her belly. "It's intelligent."
"Impossible,"
Commodore Pine snarled, gripping the chair in both meaty hands and stepping back to stand even with Benedict and Gwen.
"Silkweavers are beasts."
"That's not a Silkweaver,"
Master Ferris said in a matter-of-fact tone. The Etherealist leaned forward and plucked a pitcher of beer from the table.
"It's a marionette.
Some sort of puppet, at any rate."
Pine scowled at Master Ferris as the man began to take a long and determined pull from the pitcher, and then turned his glare to Gwen.
"How drunk is that man?"
"He's an Etherealist," Gwen said, "and quite."
"Huh?"
Pine blinked, eyed Master Ferris with decided apprehension, and said,
"Ah." "We have to get Ferris out of here,"
Benedict said in a low, tense voice.
"It's here for him."
"Quite," burbled Master Ferris, from the midst of another drink. He coughed and wiped at his mouth.
"Quite, yes, it's been sent to stop me from interfering."
"With what?"
Pine demanded.
"I really have no idea,"
Ferris said happily.
"I've been changing my mind all night, which is why he can't find me, I presume."
Gwen watched in horror as the Silkweaver waited until several folk had pressed toward the doors to the kitchen together, and then it simply flung itself at them in another fantastically powerful bound. It struck them like a runaway freight cart, making wreckage of bodies in a chorus of screams. Its many legs struck like deadly clubs at whoever survived the impact. A drunken, armed patron discharged a gauntlet into the thing from no more than a foot away, but the Silkweaver's carapace shed much of the force of the blast, and the attack did little more than melt a small crater into its hide.
The weapon did get the creature's attention, though, and it turned, lightning quick for something so large, and its jaws opened into three parts that closed on the armed man's gauntlet wrist
and severed it from his body as neatly as the Lancaster's gardener clipping a rose stem. After that, the silk weaver began spinning again and barricading the door to the kitchen with grisly corpses and silk webbing. The folk remaining in the room were fleeing toward the stairs, the only exit remaining to them.
"Stairs," Benedict said in a harsh voice.
"No, we can't run. We have to kill it,"
Gwen heard herself say in a hard, vicious voice.
"Gauntlets are useless against that armor. If we trap ourselves in narrow hallways and tiny rooms, we play to its strength, and it will murder us all one at a time. We're still guardsmen, Benedict."
"With orders to protect Master Ferris."
"We protect him by killing that horrible thing before it hurts any more Albions," Gwen spat. "Right here, where we have room to use our numbers against it, while we still have them to use."
"Little girl's right," Commodore Pine grunted. "Rats take me, that's a huge one, but not invincible. If we can get to its belly, we can kill it. Nothing but blubber and arteries down there. A shot to its head might do the trick, if anyone can make it around the armor."
Gwen nodded sharply. The silk weaver had its head shrugged down behind its knobby armored shoulders as it worked, a difficult target, and one that would not sit still once someone pointed a weapon at it. She turned to the etherealist.
"Can't you do anything?"
"I'm afraid my cane is upstairs in the suite," Ferris said apologetically. "It would have given me away. Without it, I can't do anything significant."
"Go get it,"
Gwen said through clenched teeth. Ferris opened his mouth and stared at Gwen helplessly, then waved his hands and said,
"But there are doorknobs, and I've sent Folly off to talk to cats."
Gwen gave him a level look, but there probably wasn't time for the etherealist to get his cane before the silk weaver came again in any case. She turned to the other survivors still in the room.
"You lot!"
she shouted at them. A group of older men pressed into a small defensive clump, just as she and her companions were.
"When it goes for the stairs, we shall attack it together from all sides."
"Semper fortitudo!"
bellowed Master Ferris.
"Semper fortitudo!"
a grey-haired, blocky man in a dockworker's jacket answered.
"We're with you. Everyone together."
"Are you insane?"
screamed another patron. A younger man in another separate knot of younger men.
"That thing will kill us!"
"Oh, God in heaven, man, do gather up your scrotum and fight!"
Gwen snarled. Benedict blinked.
"Even if we can engage it," Commodore Pine said, "if we can't get to its belly, we can't kill it. It'll just hunker down under its shell."
Gwen looked sharply around the room and found a possible solution.
"Should that happen, I'll make sure it does not have the luxury to remain still. Benny, can you keep its attention for a few moments?"
"As you wish, cuz," Benedict said, baring his pointed canines in a savage smile.
"Planning to threaten it with treason?"
"You simply won't let that go, will you?"
"It's about to come again,"
Master Ferris said calmly.
The silk weaver compacted a last pair of grisly corpses into the doorway. One of them, Gwen thought, might still have been moving. Sealed them in tight with its silk and swarmed up onto the bar, its weirdly segmented eyes scanning the room as its legs danced restlessly, as if eager to pounce upon another target. Benedict obliged the creature, gliding out into the open floor directly between the enormous silk weaver and the staircase, sword in hand, and turned to face it alone, isolated from any of the defensive pockets of survivors. The silk weaver was a predator, a creature that sensed vulnerability and attacked it. It leapt at him at once, as swift and deadly as when it had slaughtered the dead strewn about the floor of the tavern. But the silk weaver's previous victims had not been Sir Benedict Sorrelin, warrior born of Albion. Gwen darted toward the bar and tried to keep an eye on her cousin, but it was virtually impossible. Not because she couldn't see him, simply because he and the silk weaver were moving too fast for her to properly comprehend what was happening. The silk weaver's massive form moved like lightning,
like some engine of destruction, its club-like limbs hammering the ground with cracks of impact like heavy steam pistons slamming the spire-stone floor. But no matter how fast the creature moved, or how quickly it struck, its blows never found flesh.